You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
All right, this is The Brian Callen Hunter Motz Show. The Callen Motz Experience.
Brian, you're really trying to solve that, aren't you?
I got to change the name. We have a very special guest. We have a Spiros Michalakis on the podcast. And he's not only Greek, he's a quantum physicist from Caltech. I've never really spoken to a quantum physicist, and I'll tell you something else. I don't know what a quantum physicist... I can tell you what I think a quantum physicist is, and you tell me if I'm right.
All right.
I think a quantum physicist deals with the subatomic world and the laws and principles that world revolves around and is governed by. So I know that in this ether, in the Newtonian world, sometimes... the laws that exist in this, in the things I can touch and feel and see, sometimes those laws reverse themselves in the quantum world, in the subatomic world, and you are a specialist in that world.
Something like that. That's actually pretty good. Quantum mechanics does describe the mechanics between very small particles and subatomic things. But the thing that is really cool about quantum mechanics is that it is supposed to actually describe everything. Mm-hmm. Not just the small things, but everything, including how planets rotate around each other, the speed of light, gravity, all of these things. And the problem we have right now is we really need to understand some fundamental things, like where does space come from? Where does time come from? Right, and how do these things come from quantum mechanics?
I love it, because I know Einstein was working on what he called the unification theory, right? Mm-hmm. Which before he died was the idea that, you know, there's got to be a bridge between the quantum world and the Newtonian world.
Yes, but Einstein was also one of the major opponents of quantum physics. Very brilliant man, right? We know that. He wrote a paper with Rosen and Podolsky, and they said at the time that quantum mechanics cannot be the fundamental theory of everything. Something is missing. And the reason was because in quantum mechanics, you get somehow for free this new resource, kind of like energy, but we call it entanglement. And entanglement allows you to teleport things, like information, faster than the speed of light, in a sense, right? We can show that this cannot really happen, but in a sense, entanglement really creates correlations between very distant parts of the universe. And he was thinking, well, this makes no sense. I mean, we know that whenever you have some action, it is very local, right? You do something here, can only affect things nearby. Mm. And in particular, he was the very big proponent of his own theory that the speed of light is finite, right? So if it is finite, then, you know, you cannot have this instantaneous action between different parts of the universe. But it turns out he was wrong.
In other words, let me categorize that. So in other words, when there's a mover. So if I move a rock, you can usually tell there's a source behind that.
That's right.
You know. But he's saying that in fact when something moves here, it could also affect another particle light years away.
On the other side of the galaxy or the other side of the universe.
How do we even know that?
How do we even know that?
Yeah.
So there was we thought actually for a while that this would be impossible to test, right? That you would actually have such stronger than classical correlations between things that are non-local. And then Bell came along, another physicist, and said, well, here is a test, right? This is an actual like statistical test. You can take measurements, and if the world is quantum, then these measurements will give you like a value higher than 2, right? But if you can only go up to the number 2, then this is kind of a classical world. You know, we justify Einstein's theory. But then we ended up getting like something 2.4. And we're like, that's exactly what we were expecting to get if quantum mechanics was actually correct, right? So it was a violation of local realism, right? This idea that the world is both locally affected and also that reality exists before we observe it. And this is something you may have heard of before.
Okay, this is amazing. So reality exists before I observe it. Dial it on that.
I knew that this is what was going to happen, by the way. I knew that you were going to get your mind blown and you would be so excited when you two met each other.
Yeah, what I want to do is make this accessible because when the minute I hear quantum physicist, we all do this thing where we say, well, he's super smart and he operates on a level that's way higher than any of it. And that is probably unfair to quantum physicists because it sounds to me like it requires a great deal of imagination.
Yes.
A great deal of conjecture, theory based on, you know, preconceived understandings of mathematics and spatial relationships and all these kinds of things.
That's right.
But it shouldn't be so out of touch. We do ourselves a disservice by being unscientific in our thinking for the most part. And most of us are unscientific, right? We always go, oh, leave that to the scientists. Mm. Those guys are super smart. And so
I really agree with that. And I think that it is important to start early, right? As early as like 6 years old, if possible, and start seeding these young minds with these ideas, these counterintuitive ideas, that in the end, if you really start thinking, go down this rabbit hole, you will see that this is the only way the world makes sense. It's just that we take things for granted. We have some assumptions about the world, like, for example, time, right? Mm. It exists. It is given by some higher entity, and we just flow through it.
Yes.
But what if time is emergent from some other mathematical structure that is so fundamental that it is actually proving itself, right? In the sense that if this assumption were not true, you could say, okay, this assumption is not true. It could be like wrong. But if it were not true, any other assumption you made would not be possible because you wouldn't be here to make that assumption in the first place, right?
So I think let's stop on the word emergent because I think that's really important because, mm-hmm. I mean, this is we had this conversation over dinner. And the idea is that it's not that time, like we talk about, like lay people often talk about there being four dimensions, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. But it's as if these things are sort of the baseline, as opposed to that time is almost a side effect.
That's right. Time may simply be a label that we put on certain events, right, relative to which we perceive change. And if you think of this label, it could be a discrete label like 0, 1, 2, 3, and so on and so forth. It could be something that is like a continuous label, like the real numbers, right? They go from 0 to 1, and there's an infinite number of labels in between 0.0001 and so on and so forth, right, going all the way there. And I think this is interesting because even if you were just to think of time as a label, right, then you would wonder, okay, would we as human beings understand that labeling as that concept that we have of time? And I think the answer would be no. Why? Because first, you can label very different things and you choose the label 0 or 1 or 2 or maybe 0, 3, 1, 2, and so on and so forth. That ordering is important, right? This is what we call the arrow of time. So why does it make sense when we watch a movie, when we watch it forward versus going backwards?
Right.
Right, and this has to do with this concept of area of time, that certain things make more sense in one direction versus another, even though quantum mechanics says that every process is reversible, right? You know, that the evolution from one state to another is equally likely than like going backwards in the grand scheme of things from the global point of view.
Yeah, it feels as though when you talk about time, we are, you know, you are this physicist who's actually working on the theory of everything. You, Spiros, are actually actively involved in trying to change our concept and notion of reality. That's a very ambitious thing. So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm being general. But I'm getting to a larger point. Time, it seems, let's take human evolution and the evolution of our physicality and our psychology and everything else. Well, and our understanding of ourselves. We seem to, as a race, as a people, to be moving in a direction where we are learning more and more about not only ourselves, but the world we live in. So that forward progression of time, there is a difference in what we look like and certainly what we know now as opposed to, you know, 5,000 years ago. So time is moving in one direction, it feels like.
Experientially, but the point is that there's no such thing as spicy food. There's food that we experience as spicy, but the chemical is not inherently spicy or not. That's how our brain processes it. And so that would be one of the things that I would wonder
Yeah, that is a good way to put it, but I think there's something even more fundamental here, right? And you know, you said, oh, I'm working on the theory of everything. No, I'm working on something actually very simple in my mind, right? Because you cannot just start thinking, yes, that's what I'm working on, to figure out everything, right? You start with something very basic. And for me, this basic framework is almost like philosophical, right? And it says that, and I'm a mathematician, so I always have to start from some axioms, some assumptions, right, that have to be self-evident, either because I say they are or because everybody else agrees with me that they are self-evident, right? So I want to come up with certain axioms, certain assumptions, that if they were not true, as I said earlier, we would not be here to even think of other ones, right? They could exist in a mathematical reality in which human beings or other observers, conscious or unconscious, would not exist. And this would be equally good universes, say, right? But if you realize that to create a theory about the universe, you actually need a very basic assumption that you can exist in a continuous experience, right? In a sense that whenever you make a measurement or an observation upon which you want to base your new data set to create this pattern recognition for your new theory, there has to be some continuity. Imagine that you're in a lab and you're trying to measure like the spin of some charged particle or something like that, right? And then you do it at one moment, and we'll explain what that means now that there's no time, right? And then you do it again, another moment, right? Say the first moment you measure it and it's like, you know, a spin up or something like that, as we call it in quantum physics. And the next moment you go to measure again and you disappear. You literally, your whole, like, it just blows up, right? That would mean that you live in a universe, in a multiverse, say, that was not stable, that did not have the structure to support creating a theory for itself.
So our universe, I mean, that's the thing, a universe without time would not be a stable universe, and so we wouldn't be here to ask these questions.
No, actually, any universe, you can create a sense of time in any universe, but it would not be one where you had an arrow of time, in the sense that you would go from some, like, likely configuration to some other likely configuration versus a very unlikely configuration. Just like when you break, you know, a coffee cup or something like that, you drop it, it's much more likely to see that happen than to see it make itself up from being broken down on the floor. Right.
So because the nature of how atoms arrange themselves.
And it's more important, like, you know, to think of this as a coarse graining, that our experience as big objects in the universe, right, says that you cannot, if you coarse grain certain things, certain configurations, microscopic configurations, right, all look the same from a certain point of view if you zoom out enough, right? And even though you have, in the totality of them, all of them are equally likely, from our point of view, from our zoom, right, certain ones become much more likely than others. And this has to do with this concept of entropy. And how do you say, like, well, this system has low entropy, so we know a lot of things about it, right? High entropy means that it is random. You don't, any one of the configurations that it is in is equally likely, kind of thing.
Like the ocean or something.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. But the thing that I want to do is to, whenever somebody tells me, okay, so I figured out the theory of everything, right? And what this means in physics right now is you try to unify gravity, say, like, you know, with the standard model, right? You know, the other three forces we've been able to unify. Feynman did some great work. A lot of people actually at Caltech did a lot of good work on this. And then you end up having something that brings these four forces together, right? Well, then I would say, okay, but all of this is based upon the framework that quantum mechanics is true, right? And what does this mean? Quantum mechanics comes with a bunch of postulates, axioms, right? One of them, for example, is that we live in a certain mathematical space of wave functions, right? These functions are kind of like waves, and what all they do is they encode information about all the possible questions you can ask, right? And you should be able to get the answer, even though it is probabilistic, right? With some probability, you will actually get this answer versus some other answer. So this is one foundational ingredient. Another one is a way for you to go from one wave function, one state of the universe, to another one. And this is what we call the Schrödinger evolution, right? Now, the Schrödinger evolution actually is a sneaky thing. It brings in the concept of time. There's a parameter T, some differential equation with respect to this parameter T. And then at that point, you have introduced time out of nowhere. It just appeared, right? And it says that at this, you know, as this parameter changes smoothly, you go from one state of the universe to another. And there's a very specific way that this happens. It brings in some other object called the Hamiltonian and so on and so forth. So what I wanted to do was to go back and say, can we get rid of as many postulates as possible from quantum mechanics, including this dynamics postulate with Schrödinger's
evolution? So postulates meaning, can we get rid of all the things we hold to be true?
Exactly. These axioms that we think are ingredients that are fundamental to be able to make the next step in our syllogism about how the world works, right? So get rid of as many of them as possible and try to derive all of them from some more fundamental theory, right? And, you know, I think that this is possible. And I think if it is not possible, then there is a very good reason why this evolution, this equation, exists in our universe and is the right one to use to actually get the answers, right?
So there's a mathematical equation out there. There's a mathematical equation out there that potentially could explain everything.
I think there's something much deeper than that.
Jeez, because I'm trying to make sense of this. It's so interesting. All right, so.
So you don't even need a mathematical equation. Mm. What you need are simple assumptions you can tell and explore with a five-year-old. And so let me try to get through that,
please,
right? If possible.
Please.
Okay, so as I said earlier, we have to be able to use an assumption, right, that is so fundamental that it has to be true.
Right.
Okay.
Like Pythagorean's theorem, right? A squared times B squared equals C squared. We know that's how you measure a right triangle.
But
or
this would be A squared plus B squared equals
C squared.
That's
what I mean.
No, this is a good point because this illustrates something that is actually not always true. This is only true in Euclidean geometries, right? You have introduced a lot of assumptions just by saying that.
Okay.
That there is, first of all, a geometry, which means a certain metric, a way to, you know, find distances
between
objects.
I'm assuming there is a geometry.
And so on and so forth.
And you've assumed it's a right angle triangle.
Exactly.
Right.
Jesus. All right, so
and not
you're
only
saying
that,
not,
that you're in a flat geometry because that thing would not work in, say, a Riemannian-like sphere, right? Something on a sphere if you try to do the same thing or in some Lobachevskian-like hyperbolic space. So all these things...
I'm taking off my shoes literally.
All these things are assumptions that we hold dear and we're like fish in the water. Right, we don't realize that we make any of these assumptions because they're so fundamental. That assumption, right, is so fundamental, the one that is self-evident, that we'd never think of it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I want to do, right, with the help of other smarter people. Mm-hmm. I want to figure out how this most fundamental assumption that has to be true for the universe to have the ability to create a theory for itself, right? This assumption of stability of experience, okay? That you can make measurements and create data out of that, and then you can find a pattern, and that you can compress all of these different configurations into a single equation, as we said, or maybe a single idea.
Mm.
That is a very special state of, like, the multiverse, right?
Sure.
Our ability to do that means that you can think of it this way, right? You have a TV, and you turn it on, right? And it makes sense if you say, you know, you see the Sopranos playing, right? But what are all the assumptions that have to go into you turning on the TV, this object, and then seeing that show? There has to be a cable going behind, right?
Yep.
There has to be like a whole team of producers and actors and all, who created this plot and put it there. You have to pay your bill. You know, you have to have electricity going on TV, all these things. You don't realize, you just turn it on, you take it for granted, right? If you were to turn on any other TV in the middle of the universe, first of all, you wouldn't be able to turn it on because there'd be no electricity. But say you did, what would you get? You just get static, right? White noise.
Yeah.
The same thing you expect to get if you were to look just anywhere but inside. In most universes, you should expect to see just static, white noise around you, just randomness, no structure like we see around us, right? So the very fact that we have all this structure and that it's not just like a picture, right?
Right.
A picture, a perfect picture of order, that it's actually more than just one time. There's a bunch of like different moments through which you can jump, right? That still makes sense. That gives a lot of structure. And we want to go backwards and try to understand from what beginnings can you actually end up having this stability of experience, a universe in which, like, we exist and it makes sense to have that kind of theory. And I think this is where the interesting part comes from, right? that it's not even math, it's not physics, right? It's simple question and answer. To ask any question, you must assume that, first of all, you exist to ask that question, right? And second of all, to get any interesting answer, it should be some structure that you can encode, right, into an answer. So that instead of you having to give an answer for every single pattern that you see, just like white noise, there is no way to compress that, right? It's just white noise. You look at like a minute of white noise on TV, you can't say anything about it, like what the next picture is going to be or anything like that, just random. But for us, we can. The whole point of science is that it can predict things. Why? I think Einstein also said, like, it is incredible that we can actually use math and physics to actually say anything about the world. That's actually, I think, very deep.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? That there are some things that are periodic, for example, right? So they have some recurrence. And, like, you know, the Earth and the sun, and that we expect, like, you know, the sun to come up every day and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
All these things, right? These are the things that make our lives so easy.
Yeah.
Because we don't have to figure things out every time for the first time.
Right.
Mm. And so, to me, this is like what is so interesting about this program, that you literally start with the most fundamental assumption you can make that has to be true, because as I said, if it is not true,
the sun's going to come up.
There is nothing. Yeah, or that like your experiences as an observer, whether you're a human being or not conscious at all, right? Just like we could just be all wiped out tomorrow, right? By some comet or whatever. The rest of the universe still goes on.
Right.
You can imagine, right? You know, there's still the planets and so on and so forth. Maybe life would emerge again.
Okay, so assuming years from now, that, so now you've made that assumption.
You want to go further now. And you want to understand from the simplest assumption you can make about the mathematical space in which observers can exist, right? Relationships between like a system A and a system B that is not A. These correlations, and you want everything to emerge from there. You want time to emerge from there. You want space to emerge from there, right? This idea that there is some finite speed of correlations at which like you can be affected by something far away from you, okay? And what does it even mean, far away? In quantum mechanics, these things have to do with like decompositions of your space into like a graph, right? Where the notion is no longer that of locality, of some geometric locality, you know, that you're close to something else, just like, you know, across the street. But it is a notion of how many people do I have to talk to, right, before I get to Brian, for example,
right?
You know, how many friends do we have in common? Like, you know, how many interactions do I need to get through,
the
fundamental
chain,
interactions
yeah.
of something to get to talk to Brian?
Which doesn't necessarily have to do with the amount of distance in physical space.
Exactly.
Right.
That's right.
It's more about like distance in terms of interactions. How many degrees of Kevin Bacon do you have to go through?
Well,
something,
so time
something more
is,
fundamental.
Time, yeah. is, time is, a, is the space between two relationships?
It's interesting because time, as we said, is just a label, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then labels don't even have to be ordered because you could have like one label being potatoes, another one being tomatoes, and the third one being cucumbers.
Right.
And you're like, how do you order them? You know, and that all only depends on maybe the order in which you want to eat these. So, but what defines that order, right? And I think what defines that order is very much connected to this fundamental assumption of stability. That if our experiences were not continuous the way they are, right? If we didn't have this illusion of the arrow of time, then we wouldn't even have the concept of time. Okay?
Right.
Because those labels would still exist, but they would correspond to catastrophically different events.
I feel like time in our ether is really synonymous with decay and with attrition. I mean, I feel like when I think of time, you either think of getting older or you think of gaining or losing something. So you're either gaining time, you're either getting more wrinkles, getting stronger, getting bigger, getting smaller. It's kind of,
it's entropy.
It's,
or the fighting of entropy.
Yeah.
And the interesting
that's how it manifests itself, I guess, physically.
Yes.
Right.
But that's interesting because